When I think about what people said about millennials and what people say about Gen Z, when it comes to actual getting the work done, I find that the work gets done in a very high quality, and perhaps like the way to get it done is different, but the end result is still the same.
When you're younger, you're like, yes, I want to take on every opportunity, every project. But as you get into more senior roles and mid-career roles, you have to consider, is it worth my time? Can I actually do this? And why should I take it?
I actually think COVID forced people to really think hard about their life and how they were structuring it and how much time they were spending at work versus with their family or traveling or whatever it was. And I think there's been a real shift in attitudes across the board, regardless of age, really.
Over the last couple of years, traditional office culture has been turned on its head in a number of ways. The rise of remote work, the explosion of the gig economy, real estate fluctuations, and more. Today's offices feel like a bigger mix of work locations, communication styles, and types of employment. And that diversity amplifies the complexity of our multi-generational workforce. So what does today's multi-generational office look like? And what are managers and employees doing to mind the gap? Welcome to Know What You See. I'm Brian Lawry, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. In this season of the podcast, I'm taking a look at the shifting world of work, who and what shapes these changes, and what they mean for us.
Aging baby boomers competing against the younger generation for jobs.
It's older workers who need to change their attitudes or face early retirement.
Why the other generations think Generation X is a little bit weird. They're a bunch that doesn't have the most positive, optimistic outlook on life.
Move over, baby boomers and Generation X. The oldest millennials are turning 40 this year, and they are shaking up the workplace.
According to the study, Gen Z and millennials are putting their happiness at home over their careers.
What is your biggest problem with Gen Y?
Instantaneous gratification.
Gen Z employees, young folks born between 1997 and 2012, are now entering their mid-20s. And like earlier generations, are often the subject of think pieces focused on their entry into the labor market. But these younger employees joined a work culture already occupied by boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials. This got me thinking about the needs and goals of these different age groups and how companies are acknowledging and addressing these needs.
My name is Edwin Ochoa. I am currently the director of partner operations at PRX, but previously served as the HR director. I've been in HR for about 10 years.
While Edwin was HR director at PRX, it merged with an older established company called Public Radio International, or PRI. PRI had been a public media stalwart for over 35 years, responsible for creating radio programs still heard today. PRX was at first a tech startup, and then a content distributor, and finally a media company.
So the way that we talk about the merger is PRI and PRX were siblings of different generations. It took getting teams together who had never worked before. It took a good amount of time, I'd say 2 to 3 years, before we really found our footing.
Now, I wonder if that also broke down along generation or age lines. Was one of the organizations, were the employees on average a little bit older, or were they more or less, in terms of the demographics of the organizations, about the same?
I think one was certainly older. And I would say that while at first it seemed as though those differences across generational lines were emerging, as the merger continued, I'd say that I was very pleasantly surprised that we had staff who, across various generations, with 10, 20, 30 years in the workplace, and some with one year to 6 months, we're eagerly waiting to jump into something new. And we're very excited about the possibilities and the opportunities.
Got it. And speaking of jumping into something new, you were there when you did the transition to remote work during COVID. Is that right?
That is correct.
What were the differences in the need for the younger employees versus the employees that had more time at the organization or a different stage of life?
At the beginning of the pandemic, because there was so much unknown, everyone was okay working from home because ultimately, you know, we were really concerned about employee health. While some of our employees did not have partners who were high risk or were high risk themselves, or perhaps they didn't have caregiving responsibilities, they had family members and other loved ones or acquaintances that they had to think about from a health perspective. So at the beginning, I'd say things didn't quite break down along generational lines. As the pandemic continued, then I think it sort of broke down along lines around, you know, what kind of space do I have to work in? If I'm in my bedroom for 8 hours a day and I have a 500, 600 square foot apartment, that's different from someone who perhaps is a homeowner or someone who, you know, has other caregiving responsibilities. But even a year, 2 years into it, then the scripts flipped a little bit where folks who were of the age where their parents were aging and had those caregiving responsibilities really appreciated the flexibility, perhaps more so than at the beginning, because they were able to continue to do their work or be able to take time off and be with their families and care for them.
And so I'm wondering what kind of support you provided to people based on those needs. Like, what did you all do, or what are you doing maybe for people in your organization? And how does that differ as a function of what people get, as a function of stage in life?
Yeah, I think underpinning everything is just a sense of flexibility, and really flexibility at our core of, you know, how we relate to each other, how we think about our work, how we plan our work. So for folks like myself who have kids, and early in the pandemic, there was no childcare. We were the childcare. So my supervisor, my coworkers, we all understood that from 12 to 1, I had to put my son down for a nap. And it also meant that for folks who didn't have those caregiving responsibilities, perhaps they had, you know, pets that they were caring for or other responsibilities. And part of that was just leaning into the flexibility and ultimately landing in a place where trying to reinforce through how we communicate that the time you need to take off is the time you need to take off. And as long as your team and your manager are aware of what's happening, then that's enough.
After working fully remote at the start of the pandemic, the office started to transition to a hybrid setup. I wondered if Edwin noticed any differences with the ease of either transition for people in different life stages.
People with kids, certainly, you know, it took a while to get that routine down. But even folks who didn't have kids and had been living by themselves, it was a shift to go from the safety of your home, of your desk, of your kitchen, into a shared space with others. And the unknowns at the time, I think, heightened that. But we tried a lot to meet people halfway and really listen to those concerns and listen to those hesitations and work with people. And if that meant, you know what, maybe because of the way that cases are going right now doesn't feel like a good time, that's okay. Like, let's talk about that. But yeah, I would say it was a shift for a lot of folks, not just the folks with kids, but folks who had to kind of think about, well, what does this mean now? I have to park in a new parking ramp. I have to, perhaps I need to be in an elevator with people. And how does this all come together? And I think with open communication, we got to a better place, a good place.
I'm a little surprised that there weren't differences in terms of stage of life. Right. So on one hand, you might expect that the workers who've been there a longer amount of time would have had a harder time with the transition, but you haven't seen that.
I'll give you this example. Folks who have been around for a longer time and their caregiving responsibilities are their pets. They designed for 2 years, they designed their days around dog walks. And so now coming into an office and not being in that physical space, it was difficult. And what that resulted in is us saying, okay, well, people can come in when they can come in and they have to leave when they have to leave. Like, whereas perhaps it was, oh, okay, we expect people with kids to perhaps leave early to get their kids from daycare or from school. Now it's like, oh, and so-and-so also has to go and let their dog out and go for a walk. It was a realization that it's more than just new parents who need flexibility, and caregiving isn't necessarily limited to children. It can include parents, it can include grandparents, it can include neighbors and other sort of relationships.
And so for the people who are new to the workforce, this is their first time making sense of how work works, for lack of a better term. Yeah. And what do you think they're learning?
One lesson that I think everyone came away with that was crystal clear is that good work can happen in an office and it can happen outside of an office. And that while in-person work has its benefits and advantages, it's not the only way to create those connections and to create that camaraderie. I think if anything, it really expanded that notion of what does effective work look like? What does good work look like? And it did create perhaps possibilities for people to imagine what their work could look like, especially I can think about when I started my career, the notion of being a remote HR person was almost laughable because the sense was, well, if you're working with people, you have to be there in person to work with people. And for 2 years, I was an HR person and also working with people, but unable to be there physically. Not to mention that I'm in Minneapolis and, you know, a good number of staff are in Boston. And that was true before the pandemic. So I think if anything, it really has expanded that notion of what work can look like and what it can be.
So what generational or life stage differences did Edwin see when it came to talking about pay? Conversations about pay historically have been taboo. I wanted to dig deeper into the way different generations of workers are thinking and talking about the topic.
I would say that it is a conversation that, like when I go on LinkedIn, it more or less dominates my feeds. Should we talk about compensation? Should we not talk about compensation? And I think that for the most part, people are becoming much more comfortable talking about compensation, how much they earn, what their total compensation package is, etc. I do think that there was a reluctance for folks, you know, even older millennials, it was something that no one should know about. But really, I think for employers, it's actually been, I think, a very positive change because what I've learned is that being transparent about your salary up front, whether it's in the application process, like literally the job application, or in the first phone screen, it helps people who are job searching understand if this is a position and a salary that works for them. And it also just is much more of a time saver, I'd say. And those are the practical reasons.
So you're HR, you represent the man. how do you think all this has affected the way the employees engage with the organization and with HR as a representative of the organization?
I'm glad you framed it that way, right? Like working for the man. And I think that there's a larger conversation about what role HR should play in the workplace, because there's a playbook, right? Of like, these are the things that HR does. And I think it's worth examining, is that how HR should be? Let me give you an example of what I'm trying to encapsulate here. Let's say you're applying for a job or you're applying for a promotion within your organization. And typically, some organizations wait until the very end to talk about compensation, and some organizations don't. They'll ask you up front, what are your salary expectations? And that question in and of itself, it kind of lays bare like the power imbalance of that conversation, right? I have the information, you don't. It's sort of a game of chicken, right? One of the things that I found to dispel that is just to come out and say what the range is and ask if it fits with someone's range, right? So therefore, it's like, I'm not withholding the information from you. You can still say, I want to think about it, but at least you have that bit of information and we can have a conversation perhaps on the same playing field. That dynamic, I think, is truer now than it was when I started in the workplace. And I think that's a good thing because ultimately what it does or what it can do is foster trust. And for folks who resist that, specifically organizations and HR teams, I think that it does the opposite. It can erode trust.
I've discussed with a lot of my same age group workers, and we said, what we value is literally your trust. You trusted us to be hired because you went through our work or you spoke to us and you believed in us. But to start working and have that micromanaging and no trust is just like, it feels really bad, but it also blocks a lot of your work. My name is Amy Chan. I'm a freelance journalist and podcast producer.
Amy is in her early 30s and has worked in and out of newsrooms and offices over the years. Currently working in her fourth office, this time as a freelancer. And full disclosure, Amy is a producer on this podcast.
I love it. I actually love being this age. I mean, I think being in your mid-30s, you have the money that you want to do stuff with, and you've gone through so many different offices that you kind of know how to deal with conflict a lot better.
I see. And in your offices, were they multi-generational, the people you worked with? What was your engagement with people at different life stages? I assume when you first started, they were older.
Yeah, I think in the newsrooms, there were multi-generational, just because I think the leadership, whether it was managers, whether it was like the VPs, they were older to me at that time when I was in my early 20s, mid-20s. So they were probably like late 30s, early 40s. I wouldn't say there was anyone over the age of 45 in these newsrooms.
Wow, okay.
I transitioned into a freelance role as a gig worker during COVID. So in these 2 years, I've had to report to myself. Other than reporting to my clients, I don't have a direct line manager, right? So I don't have to be micromanaged.
Do you like yourself as a boss?
I think when there's less touch points with different people, things move really quickly. There was a period of time, I think, when I was working so many different gigs, maybe 5 to 6 gigs at once. And I would look and be like, oh, it's 9 p.m. and I still am working. And I would work on Saturdays and Sundays. But I don't know. I don't mind myself as a boss because if anything, I made the bed, therefore I have to lie in it. Whereas you can't really control your line manager, or when you're in a company, what is the leadership? What is their goals? If they're just managing up, I talk back to my coworkers who I think back in all these companies, you know, even if we had a terrible time, we had the best coworkers. And it's like, they know how to pick your coworkers. They're brilliant. You know, everybody's really willing to help out. But it's just some way along the way, I think the leadership just didn't know what they were doing? Question mark.
Do you think people in your cohort have less faith in management or in organizations generally than older cohorts?
Yes, we do have less trust in our work. I think we're kind of between an older generation and still the Gen Z. We're not quite there yet. Like, I'm going to quit today. I still think about, hey, did I use all my benefits? I still think about, have I saved an emergency fund? When we have these virtual coffees with coworkers, it's like, if they're complaining about the job and like, I'm going to quit, I always encourage them. How can this job, how is it advantageous to you at this moment? Does it build your resume? Are you on it for the health benefits plan? Are you learning a skill? Are you taking tooling classes? Like, it's not just a rash decision to quit. It's kind of like, let's plan to quit, but like, let's do all these things before I quit.
And what has been your like developmental arc of work? How have you experienced change in the workplace and change in your expectations over time?
For me, I think in this time in my career, I would say I follow that work to rule. I'm not going to go out of this way. I've seen so many people being laid off, whether it's my coworkers, whether it's my managers. I think I remember my first job back in Toronto. It was in a huge newsroom, and they were just doing, you know, you got called into this boardroom, and if you came out with a packet, you got laid off. And our direct line manager, who was just so trusting, gave us the autonomy to experiment with things that we did as young journalists. He got laid off. And I actually cried. I didn't expect to cry, but I was really shocked that this person was gone. Like, who are we supposed to go to now? And because he gave us trust, because there was a lot of autonomy and good feedback and good leadership, we were all just really sad that this manager was gone.
From the people I spoke to, I heard some common threads: a need for trust, flexibility, and respect for what everyone brings to the table, no matter their generation.
When I think about what people said about millennials and what people say about Gen Z, when it comes to actual getting the work done, I find that the work gets done in a very high quality, and perhaps like the way to get it done is different, but the end result is still the same.
What do you think is the best way to get people to work together, to move beyond those kind of generalizations and benefit from a multi-generational workplace?
Yeah. Before jumping into a tactic or an exercise, it's focusing on principles. So I think what happens in the workplace is folks who have more experience and more knowledge assume the role of, I am going to impart knowledge onto you. And folks who don't have as much knowledge or experience are the ones receiving that knowledge. Just because someone is new to the workplace doesn't mean they don't have experiences, perspectives, or knowledge that is worth less, right? I think that we should pay attention to how someone new to the workplace sees efficiency, how they see effectiveness. And if someone from a younger generation feels like the way to advocate for change or the way to approach the non-work side of work in perhaps a braver way, I think that's important to sort of tug at that and understand that, because it should be a two-way street and shouldn't just be, hey, just because I've been doing this for 10 years, now you have to take everything I say as gospel. Both people have relevant and important knowledge to share.
Amy and Edwin are both in media, which comes with its own sense of mission and determination. But few sectors demand as much idealism or mission focus as politics, especially for young staffers who are expected to do much of the grunt work for little or no glory.
Politics is the art of the young. It is absolutely driven by, and we survive on the backs of, younger workers. And I am an absolute fossil and dinosaur in this industry at over 50 years of age. The vast majority of campaign staffers are in their 20s. Craig Hughes, I'm a partner at Hilltop Public Solutions. We are a political consulting and public affairs company.
Craig is one of the preeminent strategists and managers of political and issue campaigns in the country. He's worked with multiple generations of political staffers and candidates. He served as Eastern Political Director in the Clinton White House from 1998 to 2000. And he's also worked on or consulted for campaigns in over 20 states in every section of the country.
I think political campaigns are really unique. First, there's all kinds. You could be on a campaign where you're running a campaign for state house and there's literally one campaign staffer. On the other side of that, you have presidential races, which could have hundreds, if not thousands, of paid staff and organizers, in addition to the might of an entire legion of national campaign staffers and the national office. So they're very, very different in terms of what type of campaign you're on. I think the unifying idea behind most of the people who work within politics is they are more ideologically driven than monetarily driven. And you get in politics for a reason, and that's you believe in a cause, a candidate, or a mission, as opposed to, you know, trying to make X amount of dollars or move up in a certain industry. So you do get a little bit of a different workforce that is very ideological and very driven and purposeful.
Since the workforce is so much younger, how does Craig approach managing them? Does he think there's any difference between today's workforce and years past?
What I do think does help me in terms of being a manager of folks in politics is I was the young kid. I was 19 when I started here. I was the youngest state director in the country for Bill Clinton when I ran the great and highly targeted state of Kansas in 1992. But I was in Little Rock, where I was surrounded by these young, passionate staffers that wanted to make all the difference in the world and were mentored by the giants of the industry who took time and patience to bring along the next generation of political organizers. And that is something in this industry that I think is consistent and laudable, is the desire to bring up talent and mentor young talent. Because again, you're not really in this for financial reward.
So it's not money driving this workforce. It's the desire to make a difference, to make their mark on the world. Was it always that way in this field, even back in the old days?
I just laugh because, right, don't all us old people say the kids today don't work as hard as we used to, and we used to walk uphill in the snow to school both ways, and, you know, it's so different. I don't think that's true. And my experience in politics is different. I'll admit that. We deal with passionate, motivated, younger workers who put in hours, who put in blood, sweat, literal tears for the causes they believe in. And, you know, people in the 70s were probably complaining about those damn hippie kids who didn't work hard, and 80s, I don't know, Michael J. Fox little kids who are only fiscally motivated. And this type of conversation happens a lot. I work with, on a daily basis, younger kids, workers, who do work really hard. I do think there is a difference with this coming generation, though. Younger workers and folks have a little bit of a different point of view of maybe things are not set up for them to succeed in a way that it was for previous generations. And I think that's healthy. You're seeing more in politics now, for the first time really over the past 4 years, unionized workforces, which limits the number of hours is the most obvious thing. Like, you know, you can only work X number of hours a week, which for somebody like me is hard to adjust to, because when you work in politics, you work nearly limitless hours. It is a brutal, brutal work regime, because usually your candidate has almost no money and no ability to really pay a large workforce. And so you are the one staffer who is delivering yard signs, the one staffer who is driving the candidate, the one staffer making fundraising calls. And so this has been a little bit of a change. I think in many ways, it's a good change to make sure that workers have the rights that they should have and that they are not being taken advantage of. So that is a new thing in the political industry that we've seen over the past maybe 4 years, really. And so I do think it's certainly driven a little bit by the younger generation, but I also think COVID forced everybody to take a hard look at what they're doing with their lives and how much time they needed to be in an office and how much time they could work from home or work from somewhere else or work via phone, change up their priorities a little bit. And I think there's been a real shift in attitudes across the board, regardless of age, really, in terms of work-life balance and priorities.
This idea of giving all to your job, limitless hours, as Craig mentioned, brought me back to my conversation with Amy. Her loss of trust in management, her desire to be her own boss, to control her hours. Amy, like many workers, is grappling with this work-life balance and re-examining the trade-offs. During an earlier time, it might have been expected that you would put job loyalty ahead of all else, of your personal life even. But now, maybe not so much.
I do have girlfriends who go back and forth on, if I have a child, will it hinder my career? And some have and some people haven't. Like, you can't have it all. Women cannot have it all. You can have however much portion in this 100% pie of life, but you choose the trade-offs. And unfortunately, it's just there because people choose to have children and it takes up their time. But also, I wanted to let them know, like, it's a very privileged way of saying you don't have to commit 100% to this job. I think my cohort especially, we've been loyal to our first and second job and were burnt really terribly and realized you didn't have to be loyal because you're just a number who gets laid off. But I think you learn how to navigate your relationships more now in work versus just be like saying yes to everything.
Amy's focus on learning to navigate relationships highlighted a theme that came up in all of my conversations. Much of work is about the connections you do or don't make with people you work with. COVID did much to strain social connections at work, regardless of stage in life.
I think there's a real downside, particularly in politics, because some of the beauty of getting involved in politics are the people you meet, the passion that you see every day, the motivation of your peers, and being able to work together in an environment where you share this goal of electing a person or creating change or doing something. And that is a much harder dynamic to create when you're remote. So I do actually feel a very real downside from the new COVID economy for political campaigns and organizing. And certainly the 2020 elections in the middle of COVID were incredibly difficult. How do you motivate your staff? How do you know what they're saying to voters on the phone? How do you know how effective they are being? How could they achieve their job of talking to voters when for long stretches of time you couldn't knock on doors? It was a real challenge. I do worry about the passion and the relationship side of politics being a little bit diminished because people are not in the same office working together quite as closely. I mean, there's a lot of people in the older generations like myself who quickly adapted to COVID and the working from home remotely or sometimes coming to the office. The folks I'm working with right now, I don't think there's an expectation that they not have to come into an office. I think everybody is still willing to come into an office. It's just not as ingrained that you do it every day so that there's a little bit more options and flexibility. But I haven't seen an unwillingness of this generation or younger workers to come in into an office environment and participate. I think the difference I feel is older workers who've been through a lot of cycles in politics and know the rhythm, it is easier for them to work remotely. I think younger folks in politics, it's harder for them to learn what they're supposed to do. And you can see how the more successful folks work and how they talk on the phone and how they run meetings. And you really do learn from just those daily interactions. And I think this generation misses a little bit of that. And I think it makes it harder to be a boss.
So what Craig is saying about being harder to be the boss these days because of lack of presence, does that extend to conversations about compensation and benefits? Craig thinks that the younger workers he sees expect more flexibility to negotiate, which runs counter to the old days when workers were expected to be content with what was offered.
I actually think there is a little higher expectation for better wages and better working conditions than there were 10, 15, 20 years ago. Absolutely. I think there was a you're lucky to get a job in politics point of view, and you're lucky if you can keep working in this industry, and you'll thank me later for giving you your big break to let you in. And I think now, number one, staffs are a lot bigger. There's a lot more demand for campaign workers than there used to be. So I think that has changed things, and the pay scale has definitely changed pretty dramatically over the past few cycles, so that there's much more of a adequate, call it, pay for especially the people coming in doing their first couple of jobs. So I think a lot of these changes are for the better and allow you to hire a more representative staff, but they've definitely required some changes. I do think that the Obama campaign did many, many, many things right, but they drilled into my head a phrase that I think permeates my view of politics, which is respect and power include. And for younger volunteers, for younger staff people, if you respect them, if you empower them, if you include them, you will get great work product. Especially, I think, in this generation, you have to anticipate that you will have to bring them into the decision-making process in a way that I don't think you necessarily did 10 and certainly 20 years ago. I had a friend in politics at one point said, you've got to be careful because people move up so fast in this industry. Chris Maher at the White House worked for me, you know, a couple cycles ago, and he's White House Press Secretary, Deputy Communications Director, right? People move up very quickly because they are allowed to succeed in a way that it was for previous generations.
To wrap up, I asked Craig to share his thoughts on the best way for different generations of employees to work together so they can benefit from each other. He's had many years of experience working with large numbers of staff cycling through his office every couple of years. What words of wisdom could he offer?
I sort of go back to the respect and power include motto of the Obama campaign, which I think has become my mantra. And I think listening is still the most valuable skill in both management and from an employee perspective. You need to listen to your superiors. You also need to listen to the people who work for you, and you need to learn, and you need to be open. Also, there's something about being bought in to your job, to your workplace, that my point of view is respected. And if you feel your point of view is respected, and I think this goes across all industries, this is not a political statement, then you will feel like the job is rewarding and you will want to stay. And there's all sorts of other factors of compensation and, you know, healthcare coverage or location that are critically important. But to me, you have to feel valued and respected at your workplace, and that comes from being listened to. I think that is the single most important attribute of workers as well as managers. If you simply accept their labor, their hard work, and provide them nothing and don't make them feel like they are making a difference, don't make them feel like their opinion, their knowledge changes how you do things, there's not a lot of reason for them to stay, either in this job or in this industry at all. And you have to know then that as you do something, whatever that job is, that you are part of this bigger effort.
There's nothing new about age diversity in the workplace, but because we're living longer, healthier lives, we can expect even more such diversity in the future. The quality of our workplaces will depend on our ability to harness the energy, ideas, and experience that comes from such diversity. New ways of working could allow the flexibility necessary to respect the needs tied to different stages of life. This flexibility, tied to respect for what everyone brings to the table, has the potential to elevate our experience of work and what we can create together. Know What You See is produced by PRX in collaboration with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Our production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez, Amy Chan, Jonathan Cabral, and Florence Barreau Adams from PRX Productions. Executive producer for the Stanford Graduate School of Business is Bernadette Clavier, with content production by Katie Wallace. For more about me or the show, go to knowwhatyousee.com. Be sure to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.